Sushi, you can probably get it now at your local supermarket, but when did it make its way to the U.S.? Maybe earlier than you think. The first mention of sashimi in English comes in the telling of a dinner that former President Ulysses Grant attended in Japan in the late 1800s. It's described in the 1879 bestseller, A Tour Around the World by General Grant, being a narrative of the incidents and events of his journey by James Dabney McCabe, who here described a state dinner.
After the Shimadai, we had a series called Sashimi. This was composed of four dishes and would have been the crowning glory of the feast if we had not failed in courage. But one of the features of the sashimi was that live fish should be brought in, sliced while alive, and served. We were not brave enough for that, and so content ourselves with looking at the fish leap about in decorated basins and seeing them carried away, no doubt to be sliced for less sentimental feeders behind the screens.
Food historian H.D. Miller has chronicled how sashimi and sushi made it from that dinner to the U.S., and he joins us from Nashville, Tennessee. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, you take us all the way back to 1853. This is 5 years after the discovery of gold in California. Matthew Perry sails to then very isolated Japan to begin coaxing them into trade relations. And I'm rushing through history here, but Americans fall in love with Japan. Talk about that first, Americans traveling to Japan and falling in love with it. Why?
Well, it's a completely alien civilization. For 250 years, the Japanese have been isolated. And for the Americans who arrive in Japan, who encounter Japanese, who begin to come to America to go to school, here's a civilization with a very different aesthetic, with a very different way of life, and in some ways, incredibly refined, which just sort of knocks the Americans out.
Yeah. Well, at first, the Japanese are not allowed to travel, so it's the Chinese who pour into the U.S. to work during that gold rush. The Japanese begin coming in the 1860s, but still, you write, the 1880 census showed just 148 Japanese in America. Then the Chinese are excluded. We've gone over that history here. They were resented for all the work that they did, and the Japanese begin to pour in. So take us from there, Japanese pouring into America, to your research and trying to find when the first Japanese restaurants were.
Well, the 148 Japanese who are in America are almost overwhelmingly ex-samurai. What happens in the Meiji Restoration is that the Japanese emperor outlaws the samurai and reduces their privileges. They're mostly warriors, but also sort of bureaucrats. And a lot of them thinking, well, here's my chance to rehabilitate myself, begin to send their sons to America starting in 1867. About a dozen end up enrolled at Rutgers, for example. Hmm. So the Japanese who are being encountered are of a fairly high level. The best students, the most sophisticated. Many of these men stayed and married American women. So there wasn't much of a prejudice, at least initially, against these upper-class Japanese.
Yeah, well, that'll come. We'll get to that. But so take us to the restaurants.
Well, what happens is after 1885 or so, the rest of the Japanese begin to appear, mostly farmers, craftsmen of sort of the lower orders. And they find that they can make themselves a very nice living with restaurants that cater to working-class Americans, these 10-cent restaurants. At this time, the average meal costs about a quarter, maybe 4 bits in a mining camp. Pretty much all across the West, we begin to see in the 1890s an entree, an appetizer, a coffee, and a dessert for a dime. And this spreads so quickly that literally it leads to labor unrest.
Yeah, there's such resentment of the Japanese who can do this so cheaply that some of these restaurants get attacked.
Yeah, the Cooks and Waiters Union, in particular, in Spokane, Washington, starts boycotting these. And from there, it spreads. The problem is that people can't not eat at these restaurants. The food is good, they're judged clean, and they're the cheapest place in town.
Well, and you talk about a group of union men in 1907 that finds four of their fellow unionists eating at the Horseshoe Restaurant on Folsom Street in San Francisco, and they beat them. And this becomes an international issue.
The Japanese ambassador lodges a serious complaint with Washington. At the same time, literally, there are people in Tokyo who are ready to go to war with America at this point.
Because of the treatment of restaurateurs.
Exactly. And school children. School children. Japanese school children had gone to school with American children. And in 1906, Eugene Schmitz, Handsome Gene, the mayor of San Francisco, succeeds in convincing the school board to kick Japanese children out of school. Beginning in 1907, Japanese children have to go to a separate school. So there's this, all these sort of things that are building up that are leading to an international incident.
Before we get to how that is handled, correspondingly, there's also, as you write, and now it brings us to the title of your two pieces on this, really, it could have been a book. The Great Sushi Craze of 1905. While there might have been workers who were storming the restaurants, there were debutantes who were holding Japanese dinners.
Starting like in 1895, there's a sort of mounting craze for all things Japanese. The Japanese are showing up, installing Japanese tea rooms and serving Japanese meals in Chicago and Paris, Philadelphia in 1876. And by 1902, the high society in St. Louis, Mrs. Finis Marshall, has an entire ball in a Japanese theme where all the lady guests wore kimonos. From there, we see it spread across the country. And by the time we're done in 1905, there's sushi being served in Bismarck, North Dakota, sashimi in Minneapolis, and these society events. The final act is in 1906, when two separate newspaper syndicates send out recipes to their subscribers for sushi. Now, neither of these recipes you'd want to eat. One is a heap of rice with fish in it.
And mayonnaise.
The other, mayonnaise, yeah, covered in mayonnaise. The other, it's not raw fish, which I think is prudent, you know, early 20th century America, but it would look like sushi at least. It was a square of rice with a piece of fish on top. Yeah. So,
well, you also found what you think is the first mention of sushi being eaten in America. This is August 18th, 1904.
Sure. It's this Ferndale Higgins, a 17-year-old, I think I describe her as a flibbertigibbet, but a delightful character, sings, plays the guitar, plays field hockey, writes songs. She even ends up having two patents to her name.
And by the way, I'm going to jump in and say, if people might remember the musical, a something, a flibbertigibbet, a something. So it's a word that was used to describe sort of the...
Sure. There she is. She's meeting with the Women's Home Missionary Committee in Santa Monica, and she serves her friends a new dish, Japanese sushi. The important thing about this is that 2 miles up the road, there in Santa Monica Canyon, is a Japanese fishing village of about 300 people where you can go and eat and dine in a Japanese style.
So one part of American society was having these parties in which people were dressing up in Japanese clothing. They were learning about shogun and the Japanese history. They were eating sushi and sashimi. In another, workers were fighting for what they saw as their jobs and livelihood in restaurants. It almost comes to a head. An American president has to intervene?
Yeah, Teddy Roosevelt has to step in. In 1907, when this international incident, the trashing of the Horseshoe Restaurant, happens, the Japanese are actually considering attacking the American fleet in the Pacific. Teddy Roosevelt puts together a commission to investigate the actions in San Francisco, and he dispatches the Great White Fleet, you know, 14,000 men and 40 capital ships. The Japanese back down, and they agree to something called the Gentleman's Agreement. The Japanese will limit immigration to America. They don't have to enact any laws in the American side.
And so is there a corresponding, we mentioned the Chinese Exclusionary Act, is there a corresponding Japanese Exclusionary Act?
It actually starts in the state of California, and some of the other Western states begin to enact laws which limit the ability of Japanese to buy land and limit the rights of naturalized Japanese citizens so that, for example, you're not allowed to become in California a notary public because your citizenship doesn't count. Mm. And then that kind of builds up from there. The Congress passes the Immigration Act of 1924, which severely limits immigration from almost everywhere except Northern Europe. And one result of the immigration restriction is that a lot of our tastes for foreign food and for exotic things goes away. And so when we reverse this in the 1960s and allow immigration again, Americans have a very, very limited palate.
Yeah,
and
right.
So it's like we're rediscovering all these things again. We're rediscovering sushi. We're rediscovering real Chinese food. And so that's why it was so surprising here in 1905 to find raw fish in Minneapolis in 1904.
Huh. It is fascinating. H.G. Miller, food historian, professor of history at Lipscomb University, will link you to his writing on sushi and his blog, An Eccentric Culinary History, I'll Say. H.G., thank you so much.
Thank you.